Okay, if, again, if you'll be opening your Bibles to Matthew chapter 17, Matthew chapter 17. Okay, so in Matthew chapter 17, we had, of course, the account of the Transfiguration. We actually dealt with that really kind of for a couple of weeks. Towards the end of 1 week, and then we spent most of the last class talking about that. But it's followed in verse 14 through 21 by the account of Jesus healing the boy with the demon. And of course, Jesus in that account has to be the one who heals him. Why?
The apostles.
Yeah, the other apostles that were left behind. It seems as though from the text that Peter, James, and John, they go up to the mount where Jesus is transfigured. When they come back down, the others are there, and Jesus is approached. Verse 14, a man came up to him, kneeling before him, "Lord, have mercy on my son." Talks about the demon possessed is possessing him, and all the symptoms of that, all the things it does, it thrashes, he throws him in the fire, tries to drown him, all these things. But the other apostles were there, and they could not cast the demon out. And so Jesus eventually cast the demon out. He attributes it, verse 20, to what? Matthew chapter 17 and in verse 20.
Unbelief.
Okay, their unbelief or their little faith. And he goes on to say, if you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. Now, in the outlines that I sent out, I did not put any questions with that text. But just kind of going through it, we went through it a little bit towards the end of the last class. I want to focus just for a moment on the end because I don't think we got here. Jesus says, because of your little faith. But then what does he go on to teach? You couldn't do it because of your little faith. For if you... Yeah, have faith as a grain of mustard seed. What do we know about a mustard seed?
It's very small.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead. I cut you off. Yeah, absolutely. That mustard seed is known as being one of the smallest seeds, but yet when it grows into a tree, it produces a tree that's plenty big for the birds and the animals to take refuge in it. And so from something so small, great things are actually accomplished by that. Now, how many, we come into a text like this and we start thinking, okay, Jesus, he's really saying if we truly had faith, we could literally say this mountain, get up and move, and it would move. What's interesting about that is Jesus never did that. We're not talking about a literal interpretation of this text. What is he doing? He's using it in the context that it's being used in to make what point? If you have faith just the size of a mustard seed, what can you do?
Anything.
Yeah, you can overcome the greatest of obstacles, right? Here the obstacle was casting out this demon, and Jesus said the small measure of faith would be able to cast this out, but obviously it's going to transcend that. Great things are possible when you have faith, like Hebrews chapter 11, we read about this list of people, this hall of faith, all these great and amazing things these people accomplished, and it was all a product of the fact that they were people of faith. Now, when we say great and amazing things, we don't necessarily mean things that they gained publicity for. But if you go into Hebrews chapter 11, you read especially of trying times. For instance, Abraham, God told Abraham, I just want you to pick up and move. Because of Abraham's measure of faith, he did just that. And his belief was counted to him as righteousness. His willingness to offer his greatest treasure in life, the promised son. But even when you go towards the end of Hebrews chapter 11, you have that long list of people who were persecuted for the sake of God. You read about the prophets, You read about people who accepted the plundering of their property, which, you know, Hebrews talks about that as well. But people who are willingly taking reproach upon themselves for the sake of their faith. And though the eyes of the world would look at that loss, even as it comes from physical possession, that loss as defeat, you know, we see that great things in the eyes of God sometimes take that shape, sometimes take that form. It is a great thing to be counted righteous in the sight of God. That is the greatest thing. And with faith, that can be done. But also, when you go into passages like Philippians chapter 4, we see Paul becoming a great example of this. Now, I know we come back to our gospel account, we're talking about Jesus casting out demons. You know, he's proving himself to be the Messiah, the Son of God, to be the Christ, and that's the specific context. But really, when you consider this principle of having faith like a mustard seed, being able to accomplish great things, I think that's what we read about in Philippians chapter 4, when Paul says, I'm not speaking of being in need, verse 11, for I have learned in whatever situation I am in to be content. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. So faith, a measure of faith helps us to overcome in times of trial. A measure of faith helps the gospel to go forth in a way that God can give the increase and the kingdom can grow. Measure of faith is what helps us to lead our families in the way of the Lord, to persevere when our faith is being tested, all sorts of things. A measure of faith is what accomplishes that. Yes, Andy.
So if you look at Mark's account about the same incident,
yes,
Jesus says this kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer. We know that the disciples had been given some spiritual gifts that they could use, that they could also perform certain kinds of miracles in and of themselves. We don't have those spiritual gifts today. Everything that we do, we have to rely on the power of prayer. That's how our faith interacts through us, is through that power of prayer, knowing that, yes, we have faith, but we're appealing to God for that power to be done for in our stead, so, or for us. And so God is acting with his power through our faith that thing might be done for us, if it be his will. I'm wondering if Jesus is basically saying in this instance, you could not have relied on your own special gifts. You would have had to have relied on your faith through the power of prayer, and it would have been God that would have removed this demon from him, not you.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too. Does anybody's version have prayer and fasting mentioned there? I know there is a version that includes that, because some of the manuscripts apparently include that.
The New King James does.
The New King James does include that. But when you think about those two, whether it's one or whether it's both of those things are the expression of a full reliance on God. When you come to that, certainly it seems to be that is the case, the kind of faith that is completely surrendered itself to a dependence on God is certainly the kind of faith that he has in store. I mean, in mind when he's talking about this. But yes, it is interesting, and I probably should have reread Mark's account. Mark's account's the lengthier of the two. But in verse 24, the boy's father cried out. I am going to Mark now, Mark chapter 9. I'm reading from the sheet, so if I jump back and forth from one to the other and it's driving you crazy, I'm looking at the sheet where they're all there in front of me. If you're flipping back and forth in your Bible, I know that's probably frustrating, but I'm reading off of this sheet. In verse 24, immediately the boy's father cried out and said, I do believe, help my unbelief. And so he acknowledges there that there was a degree to which he lacked in faith. And the apostles acknowledge the very same thing as well, as they ask Jesus on one occasion to increase our faith. Yes, Josh?
Just
fixing the mic. Okay, thank you. Okay, I think there was something else. Let me come back to our text. Okay, let me just pause. I don't think I wanted to bring anything else out. Is there any other questions or comments that anybody wants to make? Okay, let's move on to, we're going to cover this next section very quickly from Matthew chapter 17, Matthew chapter 17, verses 22 and 23. Matthew 17, 22 and 23. Now, you might remember at the end of chapter 16, Jesus foretells his death and his resurrection. He does it for the second time. We read there's three times he does it in the Gospel of Matthew. This is going to be the second time in these two verses. As they were gathering in Galilee, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day." And they, of course, speaking to those disciples there, were greatly distressed. In Mark's account, in verse 31, the Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him. When he's been killed, he will rise 3 days later. They did not understand this statement, and they were afraid to ask him. Luke's account reads similar to that. They did not understand the statement. It was concealed from them so that they would not perceive it, and they were afraid to ask him about this statement. And it's kind of interesting, too, in Luke's account. These are short, so it's easy to read all three of these. But in Luke's account, in verse 44, he said, "Let these words sink into your ears." It's almost as if he anticipated that this was going to go quickly in and quickly out. He wanted them to process this information. You just think about the simple fact that Jesus is repeatedly preparing them for this. He wants them to understand what's going to happen so that when it does happen, it's not just being pulled out of thin air. They can relate it back to Jesus said this is what he was what was going to happen. Jesus acknowledged his purpose. And, you know, honestly, we talk about things such as the resurrection being faith-building in the eyes of the apostles. Nothing like that they would have ever seen. But let's come back to even this instance. This man predicted just about everything that was going to happen to him. It was outside of his control. He didn't go talk to the Pharisees in a dark room behind their house and say, "Okay, when you arrest me, I want you to do these exact things in order that I might fulfill prophecy." No, Jesus just told his disciples, "This is what's going to happen. I'm going to be arrested. I'm going to be killed. And in 3 days, I'm going to be raised from the dead." And don't you know when that happened? Just such short verses here in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But don't you know that those apostles immediately, after the clarity kind of comes into play, they still aren't expecting the resurrection when it happens, but after it, don't you know they relate it exactly back to Jesus' words? He predicted it, he knew it, and he simply proclaimed what he knew was going to happen. He is the Messiah, he is the Christ, he is the Son of God. I didn't plan to spend a whole lot of time on those texts just because we did when he did it for the first time, but is there anything anybody wants to bring out of that before we move on? Of course, that's the climax we're working towards, right? That's the gospel message Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. That Jesus died, was buried, and on the third day he rose from the dead. We were witnesses, we saw it, and now we proclaim the message of resurrection to you. That's what makes up the rest of chapter 15. Okay, then let's move on in our text to Matthew chapter 17. Excuse me, Matthew chapter 18. Nope, Matthew chapter 17. Sorry, we're not in Matthew 18 yet. We haven't done the verses 24 through the end of the chapter yet, the temple tax. Okay, I believe, let's see, yeah, so Matthew's account, Matthew's the only one that touches on this. So we're going to read verses 24 through the end of the chapter. Matthew chapter 17, verses 24 through 27. When they came to Capernaum, the collectors of the two drachma tax went up to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the tax?" And he said, "Yes." When he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others?" And when he said, "From others," Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are free. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up. and when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself." Okay, so it's interesting here in verse 24, these men come up and say, does your teacher not pay the tax? And Peter, just without skipping a beat, how does he answer?
Yes.
Did I go off? It's interesting. It's interesting how he answers for Jesus, isn't it? How for just a moment he just takes into account what Jesus' answer is going to be. He just assumes. I don't know if it's maybe for fear of how they would respond if he was to say no. Maybe he simply did not know the answer to the question and he was just giving Jesus the benefit of the doubt. I don't know. But in the end, what is Jesus' answer? Is Jesus going
to
pay it?
I don't have to, but I will.
I don't have to, but I will. That's exactly right. When you come into, when we think about this text, from whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from their others? Obviously, what is he attributing himself as being? What is he claiming in how he's speaking with Peter? He's the Son of God. That's exactly right. He is essentially proclaiming that in his question, what do you think, from who do the kings of earth take toll or tax, from their sons or from others? And he said, from others. Jesus said, then the sons are free. However, not to give offense. So he's saying, I'm the Son of God. I don't have to pay this tax. I'm not required to pay this tax. And it seems as though, the disciples, by nature of being those of the kingdom of God, being his disciples, maybe they don't have to do it either, by nature of who they are. But Jesus says, for this purpose, simply to not give offense, he said, I want you to go and take the fish, the first fish that comes up, and we're going to pay that tax. And so essentially what he's saying is, this is not required, but in consideration of others, this is what we're going to do. You know, it's interesting. I wonder if maybe what he has in mind in Matthew chapter, as he moves on in Matthew chapter 18, which we will get to in a little bit, the first few verses talk about the disciples arguing about who is the greatest, but then it moves in verse 7 through 9, about woe to the world for temptations to sin. He says it's necessary that temptations come, but woe to the one by whom it comes. Could it be that maybe Jesus feels as though by not paying this tax, it puts a stumbling block in front of somebody else? It maybe offends their conscience and goes against their conscience. They're not going to pay the temple tax, and in doing so, they're not going to sin. Whatever the exact reason is, it seems as though it's the same situation as when Paul takes and circumcises for the sake of just removing it as an obstacle when it comes to teaching the gospel. It's not necessary for those who are Gentiles. It's not necessary at all for the sake of the gospel post-Christ. But for the sake of removing it as an obstacle, as he seeks to speak with specifically even Jews, he goes ahead and has that done anyways. He's free from it, and those with him are free from it, but he removes the offense by going ahead and doing it anyways. Go ahead, Stephen, when you get there.
I was just going to add what you were saying, because Jesus didn't have a problem pushing buttons. I think of all the examples of healing on the Sabbath that got under their skin so much. But it seems like every time he did that, he had a purpose for it. And this, for whatever reason, wasn't something that he saw as being a necessary stumbling block, like you said. He goes on, and just a few chapters later, in chapter 23, he spent the whole chapter just calling them out and dragging them through the mud because of all the things they're doing. For whatever reason, paying the tax was not something that he was going to call an issue over.
Exactly. Yeah, it seems as though he's kind of picking his fights. Now, in chapter 23, like you said, he picked it. and he just rapid fire, just went after them. He was honest, and he was very quick to call out hypocrisy. But in this occasion, it was simply seems to be him simply wanting to remove an obstacle when it came to what he was doing, and kind of appealing to, you know, even when Paul talks about, you know, if for the sake of my brother I have to give up meat, I'll give up meat. Not because I'm required to, but because if it offends the conscience of my brother, then certainly for the sake of the one for whom Christ died, I will do that. And so Jesus goes and he pays that temple tax. You know, it's kind of interesting. I just wonder, you know, how did God work that little miracle there at the end? You know, did God form that coin in that fish's mouth, or did God by his providence 2 days earlier send? It was actually common. Sometimes they actually found coins in fish's mouth. They would pick them up from the bottom of the seabed. Was it simply providence that 2 days later God had that fish go and pick up that coin off the bottom of the seabed just for that purpose? You know, obviously it's in the story, it's attributed to God, because Jesus said, go, and the first fish you catch is going to be the one with it's in its mouth, and you're going to take that and you're going to go pay the tax. So it was of God. My imagination and my curiosity just can't help but think about that. It's just, you know, it's something we don't generally pay attention to as far as the miracles of Jesus. We don't highlight it very much, but it's actually really cool. Can you imagine being the one? Jesus said, go catch a fish with a hook. You're used to doing it with a net, but go actually fishing. And the first fish you catch, when you open that fish's mouth, there's going to be a coin in it. And I mean, just putting myself in that situation, I don't know what I would have done, but it would have been pretty crazy. You know, even things like this, you know, we read about these men, these disciples of Jesus, and they're witnessing the exorcisms, they're witnessing the healings. These things like this are steps as well. You know, I can only imagine that they're storing these little moments like this away, because though they seem little moments to us, because we're considering everything Jesus did, these men are with Jesus one day at a time, and everything's just blowing their minds. Jesus says, go and take the first fish that comes up, cast the hook, take the first fish that comes up. When you open its mouth, there's going to be a shekel there. Take it and pay the tax. And it just highlights, you know, we need to be given the same kind of thought, you know, to our circumstances as well. Whatever those circumstances happen to be, just considering how can we be more like Jesus even in these regards. I know there's a lot of concern nowadays with politics and things over rights and liberties, and we're not getting into that discussion, but at the end of the day, am I willing to give up what is a right or a liberty for the sake of doing what may be best for those around me? But even in spiritual context. Let's see. Okay. It kind of leads us, by the way, into this next section in Matthew chapter 18, because what Jesus is going to say in response to the disciples, they're arguing. They want to know who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Without even reading it, does anybody remember what Jesus said? Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Yeah, the one who humbles himself like a child. And I want you to pay attention. You know, Stephen answered that perfectly, a humble child. Because Jesus gives in the text that's the attribute about children he's highlighting. Okay, I know, you know, we've probably heard it before. People will go in and say, well, children are innocent. Yes, they are. That's not what he's talking about, though. He's talking about humility. And so when Jesus comes into this text, Matthew chapter 18, verses 1 through 5, he's highlighting that the greatest in the kingdom of heaven is the one who humbles himself like a little child. So let's read that now, Matthew chapter 18 and verses 1 through 5. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And calling to him a child, he put him in the midst of them and said, "Truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a great millstone fastened around his neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea." I'll tell you what, I didn't mean to read that verse 5 yet. We're gonna deal with that in the next, when we read verses 7 through verse 8. Let's just talk about the one who is greatest in the kingdom, and then we'll talk about receiving one such child. I apologize, I sent these out really, really, really late. Too late to really be effective or give you time to do anything with it. But Matthew, Mark, and Luke's account, if you happen to pull that up and happen to it, maybe at least have time to read that text, did anybody notice that there something that seems to be an apparent contradiction in how these three accounts are on the way they had discussed with one another which of them was the greatest? Luke's account, Luke chapter 9, an argument started among them as to which of them might be the greatest. But Jesus, knowing what they were thinking in their heart, took a child. He stood him by his side, and he said to him, and he goes on. Okay, so it's interesting. The stories read a little bit different. What's different about them? Anybody notice it?
Who initiated the conversation?
Number one, let's just ask this question. Is it important? Okay? Is it? Okay, in the grand scheme of understanding the account, no, it's not. But we want to know if it's a contradiction, right? Okay, is it a contradiction? Okay, not necessarily. Because for it to be a contradiction, we have to assume Matthew, Mark, and Luke, every single one of them gave us every single detail, right? And when has that ever happened in Scripture? You know, we even read in John chapter 20 that if all the works of Jesus had been written down and recorded, there would not be, the world could not contain them. And so every detail is not always given. What we see are different aspects of the story or different portions of the story being highlighted. And I actually meant to bring it with me. I've got the fourfold gospel. I think it's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John put in harmony, and the texts are actually put together where it kind of reads with all the details. And did a great job of showing how this can actually work. And it's not trying to manipulate the text at all. It's just highlighting the fact that certain ones highlight certain parts of the account. So it seems more to when you try to harmonize them, they were having this argument. They came into the place. Jesus asked them, "What were you arguing about?" They were silent. They were embarrassed at first. Jesus put this example to them. And finally, they have the nerve to say, "Okay, Jesus, well then who is the greatest?" And it's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke's account, though they highlight different parts of the story, you have to assume we have access to every single detail in order to make the claim that that's a contradiction. It's not. We don't have access to every single detail. Matthew focuses on one part, Mark focuses on another, Luke focuses on another, and they do not necessarily contradict one another. But this conversation is initiated. The question is the same: who is the greatest? And like Stephen said, the greatest, Jesus says, is the one who humbles himself like a little child. Mark's account says, taking a child, he set him before them, and taking him in his arms, he said, "Whoever receives one child like this in my name receives me, and whoever receives me does not receive me, but him who sent me." And so it's not just about being a humble child, but accepting other children. So thinking about some of these texts, obviously what quality of children does Jesus seem to be appealing to? It's the humility. What's the answer to the question, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? The one who humbles himself like a child. How does that play out? How does a person demonstrate humility? Oh, I'm sorry, Josh, I didn't see you there. I had this down for too long. Go ahead.
I was just going to mention, The obvious thing, other option is that the three accounts that we just read on didn't happen at the same time. Two of them could have, and one of them may not be.
Okay.
Jesus, this is... if Jesus ever didn't get his point across when he was trying to teach someone, this would be one of those things. This argument comes up multiple times in the Gospels about, hey, I'm greater. You know, they went back and forth, and it wasn't until the night of his arrest that Jesus finally drove the point home by washing the feet and teaching them who is the greatest. It wasn't until that night that they actually understood this lesson. So this lesson's taught several times throughout his ministry, and I would just say that it's most likely that it was just two different occasions that we're reading.
Okay.
They sound similar because it's the same topic, and Jesus probably taught the same way.
Okay. Could be, and we do read of that happening with different accounts throughout the Gospels, as Jesus reinforcing the same thing over and over again, doing it on different occasions. So that's very much a possibility as well. Coming back, I want to look at Matthew chapter 5 for just a second, because it's interesting thinking about this idea of whoever humbles himself like a child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. It's interesting, Jesus really opens up the Sermon on the Mount in that way. The very first thing he says speaks to the idea of meekness. Not, well, humility. He talks about meekness in verse 5. But blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. When I think about being poor in spirit, I think about one's realization that they are absolutely nothing without God. It's that humility. You know, we have the Pharisee and the tax collector, and the Pharisee was praying. He wasn't like the tax collector, and the tax collector was, he wouldn't even look up. He was beating his breast, just begging for God's mercy, knowing that he was unworthy. That's what humility is. It's not about comparison. It's not about comparing to those around us, but realizing how we stand in the presence of the Almighty God and letting that humble us and affect everything. The greatest in the kingdom of heaven, ironically, is not the Pharisee who looks down upon everyone else and measures everyone else by what he's doing, but it is the picture of the tax collector in that circumstance where he is simply measuring himself in the sight of God. You know, it's kind of interesting. I think it's important. It's an important thing all the time, but I think one of the saddest things. Considering our day in our time that we've seen, I have a cousin who preaches in the Philippines, and he put out a great article about it within the past couple of weeks. But you know, it's interesting. We talk about humility and putting others first, Philippians chapter 2, and counting others as more significant than ourselves. You know, we all understand that. That's what the Bible teaches, and we see Jesus on the cross. We have that perfect example of what that looks like. One of the saddest things is, you know, we see Christians today trying to force their own definitions into that, or force their own applications into it to the degree, you know, the conversation today is humility and love is only vaccinations, or humility and love is only not vaccinations, or humility and love is only mask, or humility and love is non-mask. And those are the conversations of the day. And basically, we take our Christian idea of love and we force our own conclusions into it. And basically, we shut the kingdom of heaven in the faces of those who are around us. If you do this or if you don't do this, well, you don't love. I'm obviously the pinnacle of this because of what I'm doing. We've made love and humility equal these things that have no spiritual relevance whatsoever. Certainly there are things we do force into that. I think one of the saddest things, and I've seen a lot of people posting stuff like that on Facebook, and I don't care how you feel about it. You can be for it or against it. I know everybody's trying to make the best decisions that they can with the information that they're given access to. I understand that, and I appreciate that. What's sad is we see people, even in leadership positions, preachers, elders, preachers' wives, elders' wives, and basically what they're doing is saying, this is the way of love, and you obviously don't love because you don't agree with me on this. There's no message of humility in that. There's no message of love. We're taking the Christian virtue and trying to force it into a mold that matches our bias towards these worldly things. And now there's just divisiveness everywhere as a result of what we're doing with the Christian virtues. I understand and appreciate that we can feel differently about these things, and we're making the best decisions that we can, and I respect that your decision may be different than mine. And we've turned to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. We've turned to 1 Corinthians chapter 13, and the attitude we need to have towards one another is this: love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It's not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It's not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing. It rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. Love never ends. That's the kind of love that we need to be seeking with one another. And the humility that makes one great in the kingdom of God is the kind of humility that we need to make it our endeavor to possess. And not only to have it, but to accept those others who are the children of God around us. Now, of course, I know when we're talking about error and things that clearly are sinful, there are responsibilities we have towards one another. But in these things, you know, to our day, we're not talking about those things. We come into our text. Jesus is going to say it's not just about being humble to be great in the kingdom of heaven, but it's about receiving those around you. And I know we've talked extensively in the past about the one another statements that we have throughout the New Testament, how we're to love one another, encourage one another, consider one another, to build up one another, to bear one another's burdens, and all these kinds of things that help us to understand what it seems that Jesus is probably talking about there. Bearing with one another, accepting one another, and as it goes on, in verses 7 through 9, not putting temptations to sin before our brethren, I think we can understand what Jesus probably has in mind, what his desire and what his will is for his people. Questions, comments? Okay. And I know, and I'm sorry, bringing up the issues of the day is kind of like rubbing salt in wounds for people. But I think the saddest thing that's happened, I couldn't help but think about it when I was reading this text, is to see people posting stuff like "love equals this." I shudder to think that those people or their spouses are in any position of leadership in the church, because that's just anti-Christian, I think, when we see stuff like that. We think about Matthew chapter 18. We look at verses 5. I'm going to go back to verse 5 now. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, but whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a great millstone fastened around his neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. Woe to the world for temptations to sin, for it's necessary that temptations come, but woe to the one by whom the temptation comes. And if your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life crippled or lame than with two hands or two feet to be thrown into the eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life with one eye than with two eyes to be thrown into the hell of fire. Okay, so Stephen went to Matthew 23 earlier, and Jesus was taking shots. This is pretty direct, too. You know, and he's talking just kind of generally to those who are his disciples. And what is he emphasizing about sin? Just in general.
You don't want to cause it in others.
You don't want to influence it in others, and then even even he goes back to what we have back in Matthew chapter 5 in the Sermon on the Mount and says, you don't want it in yourself either. You know, essentially, you know, and maybe he's reminding them of what he said earlier to say, this is what sin does, so don't do that to somebody else. But we have it in Matthew chapter 5. We have it in Matthew chapter 5 where he already has dealt with that in the context of lust in chapter 5 verses 27 through 30. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out, throw it away. It's better you lose one of your members, your whole body be thrown into hell. It's pretty much word for word of what Jesus is quoting here. But the wages of sin is what? Death. And sin is the sting of death. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Sin is what makes death a defeat. And so the wages of sin is death. We don't want to be the ones to cause that in somebody else. We certainly don't want it in our own life. We want to overcome sin by the power of the gospel and the grace of Jesus. By walking by faith, we want to live the life that he's called us to. But we also want to have that same care and concern for those who are around us, our brothers and our sisters who we walk with, and are to be encouraging. Hebrews chapter 10, Hebrews 3 and chapter 10. Encouraging one another daily as long as it's called today, so that none of you are hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Striving to enter that rest, locked arm in arm, rather than pushing one another away. We don't want to put obstacles in front of people. We don't want to put temptations in front of people. We want to set good examples for those who are around us. Because we want victory in Jesus for those who are around us well. We don't want that bondage to sin. We'll come back to that text. We didn't get to spend a whole lot of time on it. But we'll come back to that text in Matthew chapter 18, verses 7 through 9 next week for just a few moments before we move on.